And we're back. Back in the studio, fresh off of recording a different intro for a different episode.
We're recording another intro for another episode of The Odd Pod Classic. I'm Valerie, here with Trevor.
Yeah, I could say my own name, but, you know, that's cool. You don't have to let me. You can...
Okay, do you want me to say here with, and then you could say Trevor?
No, you don't have to start my sentences for me. I can just speak for myself.
Okay, let's go again.
I'm Valerie. Trevor. I'm Trevor, and this is Valerie. She's with me. I'm with her. Wait, which one makes me sound more important? Am I with you or are you with me?
Well, I feel like if you say I'm with her, I sound like Hillary Clinton, so probably
that's
she's
true.
With me.
That's true, but we are stronger together, and
Jesus Christ. Today, we're...
This is an all-new Odd Pod Classic. It's not all new. I mean, it's an all-new in the sense that this intro is new.
Yes.
The episode's old.
Yes. Lots of dated references.
Ooh,
to
great
the...
song on this one.
Very
I just
good
remembered
song.
That incredible song from the movie that we bookend the episode with. Mm-hmm. I can't wait to hear it.
I remember we started the episode talking about Crypto.com, the Crypto.com like arena.
Really?
Yeah.
Was that... How long ago was that? Jesus Christ.
It was like November 20... What? God, fuck.
2012? It was 10 years ago?
November 2021.
Okay.
Yeah.
So like a year ago?
Yeah.
The crypto... Okay, I got mixed up in my head because we recorded it then, but then we released this in like February or something.
We did, yeah. It was like way behind, yeah.
My bad. I've got a regular gig producing a podcast now, and I'm actually getting paid to make sure it gets edited and released on a weekly basis. So like, I have to not be in super lazy like I always was with these.
Yeah.
I have to actually make sure I do it because they're paying me.
Mm-hmm.
I hate the word gig, but it sounds dumb to call it a job.
Yeah,
you know, because it's not really a job. But I hate calling it a gig, but I don't really know what else to call it.
Contract work.
Yeah, I'm a contractor. I'm officially a business owner now. I own a podcast producing business. And this is, it's so funny to me. I think about when we did Mathal May, that was what, a total of 6 episodes that we did in
6 episodes in 1 month. Yes.
Yeah. In to be fair, a little over a month.
Yes.
I tried to get them all out in 1 month. I think it spilled over a little bit into June.
Yeah. Like I think like the Will Sloan episode aired on like the 3rd or 4th of June, but that's,
but the fact that I did all that, like, was able to motivate myself to do all that without even technically we're making Patreon money, but that was like not really anything. like motivating myself to record and like to prepare and record and edit 6 whole episodes in a month is so insane to me. But by the time you're hearing this, I might be doing that with as many as 8 episodes a month for a new podcast, which you'll know what it is by the time you're hearing this. It's called Crime Watchers.
Okay, perfect.
Well, as long as I'm here, please check out Crime Watchers.
Yes,
it's hosted by Ben Flores and Sarah Black. It's really, really funny. I'm really glad to be working on it. It's great, and you should check it out.
Do it.
It's available. It's available wherever you get your podcasts.
Wherever you get your podcasts, whether it's Stitcher,
it is on every
Spotify.
Podcast app. It's on Stitcher. It's on Spotify.
Overcast.
Find it at Apple Podcasts. It is on Apple Podcasts and Overcast, because Overcast just indexes from Apple Podcasts, so it's on both. I saw to it personally this on all those platforms. You can hear it at anchor.fm/crimewatchers. Really funny stuff, but that's not what we're here to talk about.
We're here to talk about my podcast. I'm also gonna like say right now that
yeah, We're here to talk about Valerie. This is really more Valerie's podcast now. I just kind of help out. I'm just kind of here, not this podcast, a different podcast. Oh, wait. Yeah. What? What do you have a podcast?
I'm going to.
Is this one of those things where you talk about something that you're
going to
do?
This one I'm actually going to do.
That you haven't
this
actually,
I'm actually
do. You're actually,
I'm actually going
to
do it.
Have you put any effort into the thing you're about to
yes.
say?
Yes.
Will exist yes. by the time they're doing
yes.
Okay.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
I'm sorry.
Yes.
Go
yes.
ahead. This one's for real. This isn't Myrna.
No,
Acula.
No.
This is the real deal.
Also,
okay.
could you cut
okay,
out the
ahead.
Reference to Myrna Acula in the A New Leaf
episode? I'm not cutting out. You want you want me to go into the New Leaf episode and cut out? I have to listen to the whole thing just to find the Myrna Acula
like
reference
last
and
minute.
Cut it out.
It's in
and
the
then
last
later,
minute.
And then later, when people are listening to this one, they're going to hear us talking about cutting out the Myrna Acula reference.
Cut this one out, too. Cut this one out, too.
We'll see. Maybe okay. I will. I don't know. I might be too busy working on my new hit podcast, Crime Watchers, that everyone loves.
Well, if you just give me a pause, I'll edit this, too. All of this, too. And I'll actually get on time. I'll get on time.
No. I already said I would do this, so...
Anyway.
People like hearing about Myrna Acula. See, we're not going to George Lucas this stuff like I joked about doing on the last one. We're not going to ruin the sanctity of the product we created by cutting out Myrna Acula. It's part of the history. Myrna Acula is part of the fabric of the...
It's the tapestry
of Odd Pod history.
When someone makes the Odd Pod wiki, when someone has like 7 full hours and is so bored that they're like willing to do that, they can just put that in like the Valerie's unrealized projects, like Ben, like how they do with Tarantino. Like, have you ever seen the
Kevin or the Kevin's unrealized mm-hmm. project section of Kevin
yeah.
Smith?
It's so funny in the like Tarantino one.
Didn't you
there's
have
like
a podcast you were going
to
plug?
Well, let me just finish this and then I'll get to it.
Okay.
It's so funny how in the Tarantino like unrealized projects, I'll be like untitled screwball comedy film. And then it's like in one interview for filmbuzz.com, Tarantino said that he would at one point like to make a screwball comedy. And that's it.
Well, he did make a screwball comedy. It was called
freaking Once Upon a Time in Hollywood.
Jackie Brown. I'm trying to think of the closest thing he's done. Well, I mean, I guess Once Upon a Time is because there's a little bit of a romantic comedy element between Leo and Brad,
mm-hmm.
right?
Yeah.
And okay, yeah, I guess that is the closest.
Yeah.
Actually.
But. Sorry, just heard
it's
noise.
Too bad he never got to make that Star Trek
yeah.
movie. I would have really yeah. liked to see the Tarantino Star
yeah,
Trek.
Yeah, that would have been interesting. Because I feel like he would have probably gotten to like the original like Roddenberry idea of having to be basically like chips but in space.
Well, I think he said he wanted to do something about like how on the original series they would go to like a gangster planet or a cowboy planet.
Yeah.
Or so. Like, I think he wanted to be centered around like a gangster planet, mm-hmm. which is interesting, and it's something they've never that I don't think I'm about to make definitive statements about Star Trek. Like I've watched all
yeah.
of Star Trek, and I haven't, so I don't know what the fuck I'm talking about.
You're not a Star Trek boy.
I'm not like. I just don't have the... There's just too much of it
yeah,
to watch.
True.
I like the idea of Star Trek. Mm-hmm. And I watched like a season and a half of Deep Space Nine because that's the one everyone says is so good. And like, it is good, but there's just too much
yeah.
of it.
Yeah, that's fair.
But I guess the Gangster Planet episodes from the original series were replaced by holodeck mm-hmm. episodes in the Next Generation. They would just go on the holodeck and go to the gangster 30s. Mm-hmm. Whatever.
Anyway,
Valerie,
so,
please tell us about your exciting new
podcast.
So
my exciting new podcast will be called Forbidden Pleasures, and it's a trans
Ooh.
Film history podcast.
And am I helping you with this podcast? Or,
if you want to
not?
Be like on the, like sometimes I'll have like panels of guests to talk about whatever I'm talking about.
Well, I mean, yeah, I mean, I'm not
a
like
panelist.
A... I don't know if I'm really qualified to be a panelist on a trans history show.
Well,
not really an authority.
We'll have history people, but also have people just to keep the show light and fun. So
okay, well, yeah. You know, I wouldn't want to put. You know, there are plenty of fun people.
More fun than you.
Well, people who are. I was going to say people who are trans who are.
No,
fun,
that's true. That's true.
Whatever. I don't. Plus, you know, I'm really more of a behind the scenes guy these days. I don't know if you heard, but I'm producing Crime Watchers, the biggest hit podcast of 2023. Mm-hmm. So, yeah.
But so, anyway, this episode is we talked about the China Syndrome, James Bridges' film with starring Jack Lemmon as well as Jane Fonda and Michael Douglas. And we had. LA comedian Eli Olsberg as our guest, who you can
my first time speaking with Eli, good guy. I was happy to meet him.
He's a very nice guy. He's been on the show a couple times. He was also on our Mikey and Nikki episode and was in our JFK special, which is on our YouTube.
Check that out on YouTube. And we need to talk about Kevin on YouTube.
Make sure to check out Eli's stuff. He has two podcasts, one called Pause the Woman, the Ever Closure, the podcast never ends. And he has a stand-up show in LA. If you live in the LA area, the second Tuesday of every month called Performance Anxiety. It's at the Pleasure Chest.
$7. All of which I think also immediately gets mentioned when the actual
it does. But I'm just saying
all those plugs. All those plugs are in there.
I'm just saying that just so people know. But
more importantly, listen to Crime Watchers and Forbidden Pleasures because those are
our shows. Those are us.
Yeah.
Those are us. Those aren't you. Those are us.
I don't know why you're saying it like that.
But listeners, those aren't your podcasts. Those are our podcasts. So you listen to ours.
What are you doing? So this was Lemon Party, which was sort of the second phase of the Adam that would ultimately become the Odd Pod.
I love how you're doing bullshit in every intro now.
I was just trying to do a callback to the previous episode where I did the whole strained Adam metaphor for no reason, made no sense. This was. The second phase of the evolution of, I guess technically the third, because A New Leaf was the first one.
That was like Patient
and
Zero.
And then it was Mathau May. Yeah, that was Patient Zero. Perfect. Yeah. I'm not going to try to come up with my own thing. And this was Patient, I like to call Patient 3. Oh, no, it'd be Patient 2, because Patient 0, then 1. Yeah. This is Patient 2.
Patient 2. Anyway,
we called Lemon Party. Now, Valerie, why is it called Lemon Party and why is that a funny name? Can you explain to the audience? Some listeners who are a little younger might not get the reference.
It was a meme of something that was not real, that was like a scare in like the
No, inaccurate.
Okay, I don't know. Okay, tell me.
Lemon Party, well, it was a shock site kind of thing, but it was a very real picture of three old men having sex with each other. That was Lemon Party. It was the website was lemonparty.org. It was kind of like a more tame equivalent of Goatsy. Instead of like a guy's asshole being torn open, it was just three old men really having tender, like I think two of them are making out and the third one is sucking one of their dicks, and it's a very tender, sensual moment between these three old men, and that was lemonparty.org. There's also a lot of references to it on 30 Rock because Liz Lemon's name is Lemon, and they would be like, you know, when she was with her family, your dad would be like, it's a lemon party or whatever.
Ah, yes. Check out 30 Rock on one of those streaming sites.
And that was like a super obscure reference in those times because people weren't really online then like they were now. So that they threw that in there just for us online heads, people like me, you know.
Just for those freaks that were in the Matrix.
I think it's safe to say they had some, shall I say, Poindexter types writing for that show. Some lampooners.
People who viewed it a little askew.
I'm trying to say they're nerds. Okay. I'm saying like they're not socially adept because they knew about internet stuff. Perfect. Is what I'm saying.
Okay. Good.
This is even longer than the last one. What are we doing?
Very quickly, let me tell you, just on the topic of science, so when I was in high school...
You're about to tell a story? Why don't we save the story for the next intro?
Okay, fine.
Oh, yeah, no, we should do a third one, and then this will be like a trilogy of intros, and people will be excited to like, oh, I got to hear the next one so I can hear the conclusion to the science... There's been a running theme of science through the whole thing, and we got
and you know,
hear Valerie's science.
There's one thing we know about our fans from polling their interests. They fucking love science.
They fucking love science, yeah.
They fucking love it.
I mean, and that's why we've always taken a very scientific approach to dissecting the careers of Walter Matthau and Jack Lemmon.
And Elaine May.
And in the future, maybe even Martin Landau? I don't know. More on that later. Goodbye. Yeah.
Maybe you could also...
No, keep talking if you have more bullshit to say.
Maybe you could also do Mike Nichols. Okay, goodbye.
Maybe. Ah, jeez. Okay. Enjoy the episode.
Very beginning of the trailers where it's just like,
yeah.
Have you guys seen the new crypto.com ad now? Because it actually plays in the middle of the trailers, like what? not during the ad portion, before the half the trailers will play, and then you get Matt Damon making this lofty speech about all throughout history, brave people of blah blah blah, and do this and that, and no idea what he's talking about. And it's like, fortune favors the brave, and it says crypto.com, and then the trailers continue.
Matt Damon?
Yeah,
that's some, crazy, because
some billionaire is like behind this crypto.com thing, whatever it is. It's very confusing what crypto.com even is, or what they have to do with crypto or whatever. And like, and yeah, and Matt Damon, I guess, is getting paid like millions of dollars to be the spokesman for it.
Yeah, that's wild. I've yet to see trailer. Well, first off, I think it's wild because I think Matt Damon's like a environmental guy.
Yeah.
He did a whole thing about frack. He made a whole movie about how frack is bad.
He does a ton of environment charity stuff, but I guess like, you know, they offer him so much money to be the spokesman for some website, and probably in his mind it's like, oh well, I can put that towards charitable whatever, you know.
Well, crypto.com is now the name of the Staples Center starting
crypto.com arena.
It's the crypto.com arena. I mean, here in Miami where I'm visiting right now, it used to be the American Airlines Arena. That's where the Heat play. Now they play at the FTX Arena, and FTX is a crypto exchange. It's exactly the same thing as crypto.com. They're both the same thing. Wow. So it's just more cringe amphitheater names. And you know, before you know it, there's going to be like, what's it called, those like NFTs with the crypto
Bored
punks
apes.
Kitty Bored Ape amphitheater or whatever. It's so depressing. It's weird because I don't know when it's what's weird is that's the kind of stuff that used to somehow, I'm still trying to figure out mathematically where this went wrong, but it is this weird thing where everything that used to be considered nerd culture actually was a nerdy thing. Like it would mostly not be appealing to anybody except a very small group of people. Most people had to keep it to themselves. I'm projecting a bit from when I was in high school, maybe, but you kept it to your fucking self because you didn't feel like having to explain something that someone would make fun of. And some weird fracture in the timeline happened where a bunch of fucking Disney movies and MCU shows are considered nerd culture by a bunch of people who were like cheerleaders and quarterbacks in high school. It's a very weird, and I think NFTs fall under that same thing where you see this like this bored ape, and I'm like, this kind of shit used to get people like people needed therapy because if they were into that in high school, it got them made fun of enough that they would have to go to like, you know what I mean? Like it was such a, it was almost like the thing that used to be like, like the source of nerd culture or whatever. Now, for some reason, it has a positive connotation because traditionally hot people took over the real estate.
I don't know if you've actually seen these people that are into the Bored Ape stuff. I wouldn't call them traditionally hot, and I think they definitely deserve to get bullied. But they're on top of the world right now.
No, I've seen them. I have seen them. You're right, but it is weirdly it is spearheaded by some people who I feel like are the people who like have like the Patrick Bateman aesthetic, you know, where it's like I feel like those are the people at the top, and then they've convinced everybody else that this is like a very cool. The worst part isn't even the financial impact it has. The worst part of it is the environmental impact,
right?
Which is actually a great segue for this episode.
You're listening. If you didn't know, this is a Lemon Party. I'm your host, Trevor Drinkwater. With me, as always, is Valerie Faye.
I'm Valerie.
And we have a very special guest who Valerie will introduce to you because I don't have his biographical details.
So we have a stand-up comedian with us today who's a writer. He's the host of the stand-up show Performance Anxiety in Los Angeles. He's also the host of two podcasts, Pod is a Woman and Closure, the podcast never ends. And this is likely the only time I'll ever get to say this unless we have you on again. He was on Warped Tour. Mr. Eli Olsberg is here with us.
Thank you for having me. I haven't heard that credit was I forgot about that. Yeah, I didn't forget about it, I guess, but it's like one of those things where I always it's a very specific audience that really appreciates that. I feel like obviously I'm guessing Valerie, you have a Warped Tour history, right?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. You did stand up on Warped Tour?
Yeah, they tried a comedy stage 1 year in 2015, and I was the only. It's a very small brag, but I basically did all 41 dates. I didn't miss a single show. My co-host Grant, he got sick he missed like one or two shows because he got sick. So I always like to brag that part. They bought on two comics to do like the whole run. And then every 2 weeks they kept bringing in two other comics. So it would always be like a four comic showcase. And if there were like local comics at certain stops, they would come on. I loved every second of it because I had just gotten out of a really exhausting day job, and it was the first time I like my job actually was to do stand-up full-time for 2 months, you know. So a lot of the other stand-ups I feel like were after like doing it, knowing they were doing it for 2 weeks, kind of were like by the first week they were kind of over it. But I think since I knew what my life was going to be like for those 2 months, I don't know, being on a tour bus is incredible. I had a basically a little less than a two-year run where I opened for bands and did music festivals and stuff, and my favorite part is that I got to sleep on tour buses, which is way more comfortable than flying and road tripping.
Oh, nice.
Yeah.
Nice.
Yeah. It was very cool. And it was also the only year that like only two like legacy bands were on, like people that I knew, because at that point I was 30 that year. So most of the bands that were there, I had no fucking idea who they were. I was just like, I truly felt my age for the first time that was like the first time I was like, oh, I am 30. Like, I think Simple Plan was on for 1 week, and that might have been the oldest band that was on during the run I was on.
Well, so as you were pointing out, we were just talking about environmentalism, which is a great segue, as you said, into the film we're here to talk about today, which is The China Syndrome, starring, of course, Jack Lemmon, along with Jane Fonda and Michael Douglas.
Yes.
Oh, yeah. Produced by Michael Douglas as well. I didn't know that until right when the credits popped up, and I was like, damn, very good on him for that. Two movies in the 70s that he produced where he didn't put himself front and center.
What was the other one?
One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest.
I knew he produced Cuckoo's Nest, but I didn't know if there were, because I think he might have produced quite a few movies back in those days before he was really a big star.
Mm-hmm. Yep. He I remember I at first when I saw that it said produced by Michael Douglas in the first time I saw. So it must have been around like in the very, very, very early 2000s. I remember seeing that. I was like, maybe it's just another guy named Michael Douglas. It's a common name. I didn't think anything of it. But then I bought the that's back when like DVDs came out as like two disc special editions. So I bought the Cuckoo's Nest one, and sure enough, I fired up the commentary, and he's the first one talking about getting the movie financed.
Yeah, and it's a great, it's an interesting early performance from Michael Douglas, because this was kind of, you know, in later like 80s and 90s, he's like more of like a sex symbol, and he kind of has this stock character as like a very like sexually charged kind of guy who's like kind of an asshole, like a very aggressive. And this is like, this is, you know, 70s Michael Douglas with long hair and a beard.
And he's a beard,
like
yeah.
He's kind of like anti-authority. He's like rebellious. And there's an interesting, although he is a little bit lecherous, he kind of sexually harasses Jane Fonda a little bit at the beginning, but in a charming way, I guess.
Yeah. Everybody in the movie is like it's so funny what used to be defined as what we were talking about earlier with traditionally hot people. That was, they're all just confident in looking like whatever they look like. You know what I mean? Like even everybody in there is just, I'm like, this is what I'm like, God, why couldn't I be around when this was, when these were the hotties? Just Michael Douglas with his confident beard and Jane Fonda, just like both of them. I'm like, yeah. I mean, do you guys know that article that came out a few, I think it was like maybe a year ago.
I do. That was on a Blood Knife by, oh, why am I forgetting her name all of a sudden?
It's too,
unfortunate because I love her writing, and I kind of sort of helped do a little bit of editing on that article because my friend Kurt runs that website. But anyway, not important.
Oh, cool.
Not important. Well, yeah,
I just thought of it in that sense where I was watching and I'm like, all of these people do have like a type of energy that is absent. Now, even watching it then, you can feel, I mean, at no point does the movie require any form of, this is like such an aside, but I was thinking like, I'm like, none of these people are, there's no like sexual tension between anybody in any like specific intended way, but you are watching and you're like, oh, these are just people who lived fully formed lives and look like they have sex and they're happy. They're, you know what I mean? Like there's not a, it's not a thing where there's like a, this like empty, sterile, antiseptic physique involved. I guess that's more what I was kind of getting at. So their looks are very, I don't know, just watching it, I was getting a little like, all right, yeah, let's save Los Angeles.
Yeah.
R.S. Benedict, by the way, is her name. Great writer, who we all admire here. On our last episode, we just talked about the 1970s King Kong, which has Jeff Bridges as the romantic lead. And he has like shaggy hair and like a stringy beard. And it's like the way he looks is like the male lead in a movie would never, ever be, especially like being the character who the beautiful woman falls in love with. Like, you would never let them look like that now.
Mm-hmm. If you really want to see what's funny is I think just a few years before that, because I was at 76. So Fat City was, I think, 72. And in Fat City, he plays like I think a 19-year-old, and he looks like such a boy in that movie. And it's just really funny that in 4 years he was allowed to become like just a complete grown-up, you know what I mean? Not that he already was when Fat City came out, but like because I think in the movie he plays like 19, but I think in real life he was obviously a few years older. There's a great scene of him and Stacy Keach sitting next to each other, and it's just funny because the age difference isn't that big, but when you see them, it's where you can see, you're like, oh, okay. Wow, one's really young, and the other. But no, it's just that's just guys being dudes.
Yeah, I like how in the beginning, so much of this movie is like about a conspiracy, conspiracies that happen, and I felt the movie was almost going to be a different thing in the beginning when it was just sort of the like guys in like the control booth like commenting on Jane Fonda's appearance and like being like, oh, we can control her. She has no say in it. We'll get her hair cut or whatever. And it's just like, I felt like so often in this movie, like, wow, Jane Fonda is so like condescended to in so many ways from so many people. And also in some senses, I saw some like bosses of the, in the scenes with like the news directors treating her shitty and condescending, and I was like, been there. Been there.
Yeah. It's apt because the movie's very much about like how information is manipulated through the media and like and then that's kind of that's sort of like relevant when they're talking about, like, you know, just using Jane Fonda as a tool. She's this like sexually appealing tool that they use to control and disseminate like information to the public, and then of course Jane Fonda is going to come up against that institution when she's trying to like report on like a real story, and they're telling her like, no, because of this and that protocol, we can't talk about that, or we can't say that, and it's like, mm-hmm. it's a very it's interesting because it's like not like overwrought in the conspiracy. It's kind of like, it's almost like conspiracies happen. It's like a conspiracy that happens sort of naturally, just by like the institutions that are in place preventing information from getting through these barriers.
It's kind of impressive that there is a scene where she's told that too, straight up. Like, there's that scene where she's talking to her boss, and she's like, I want to do real news. And he's like, look, you didn't get hired for your journalism.
Right.
Like, mm-hmm. like that's not why you're here. And he like just straight up tells her. And then like also at the beginning too, Valerie and I were talking about this right before recording, which was, I was surprised that, you know, movies specifically, it's kind of this very, I feel like 78, 79 was kind of where the shift happened, where the editing became more rhythmic, where it could, because up until then, movies didn't really have a defined style. You know what I mean? Like, you went mm-hmm. in to watch a movie and things played out however they played out. There was the all that like Sid Field three act structure stuff didn't really start to take off until that point. But I feel like it reminded me a lot of, they're two totally different movies, just to be clear. This is like strictly as an editing reference, but like, I was reminded a lot of All That Jazz, which came out the same year, where they both just kind of move at this very specific rhythm. So it's like a very, mm-hmm. I felt like this movie was like the sturdiest version of itself possible, where it's just very sturdy and it kind of moves very, and I was kind of ready to see something a little more like taking its time, and it doesn't. It really just kind of hits the ground running and just like really like, it's very like kinetic for something so that was made in like 1979, and I feel like that was kind of the period right before studio filmmaking really started to kind of have that kind of became the way people were trained to see movies, you know, as like mm-hmm. with three acts and all that kind of stuff. That's where it really started to take hold, and that's what I was surprised about with this. It was the same thing, I would say obviously back then movies were allowed to be for adults first and foremost, so mm-hmm. it deals with everything kind of like in that same way, where you're surprised to see a studio movie where a guy straight up tells Jane Fonda, look, we hired you for your looks, or, you know, a movie where you know, people were kind of anti, you know, Michael Douglas is like an anti-authority guy and he's not painted as like the problem.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah. It struck me like the editing, it felt almost Godardian at certain points, mm-hmm. just like that sort of, like you said, the rhythm, and just how like, I feel like something that doesn't get talked about enough with Godard is just like how like, this isn't a word usually used for him, but like economical in a way. Like sometimes his movies like can be like,
oh yeah, absolutely.
Economical. And like, I saw that a lot in this movie with just like how just everything just flowed in a really like streamlined sense. It just like felt like everything was just as it needed to be. And at 2 hours, it was like a very brisk 2 hours, at least for me.
Absolutely. Yeah. Yeah. Totally. It totally has that. Exactly. And like, you know, it only starts cross-cutting quickly when things get really tense, or, mm-hmm. you know, it just kind of keeps going that way. It really has a, because it snuck up on me where I was like watching it and just kind of, I was never bored at any point. But then when the second hour kind of kicks in, where all the corporate interests start pounding down on them, mm-hmm. I really felt myself like on the couch, like, oh shit, what's going to happen next? What's going to happen? You know what I mean? Like, there's mm-hmm. a lot of those, I feel like a lot of legal dramas or anything that deals with like any kind of legal corporate stuff usually deals with it like more removed a lot of mm-hmm. the times, where it's like a lawyer who discovers this, or somebody who's like, you know, some small case suing, and then they find a bigger conspiracy. Whereas this actually is like a news crew happens upon something, and then you really get to find out how like even journalism, which is supposed to be like the first place that really is in charge of informing the public, can even be.
Yeah. It's of the about it, and basically they based the sequence of events and how all the accidents occurred on like an actual incident. I think it was a nuclear plant near Chicago, and like it was like called the Dresden plant, I think, in 1970. So like so there's this feeling of like authenticity, because they like based like the, you know, like the details mm-hmm. of how the mm-hmm. technical stuff unfolds on a real event. And then, you know, you throw in these reporter characters in the right place at the right time, and you give Jack Lemmon's character this sort of moral crisis mixed in with it, and you get this very great sort of naturalistic pace to the story that feels very authentic. And you know, it's almost cliche to talk about how like, oh, you know, Hollywood in the 70s, you know, if so they don't make them like that anymore, but it's so true. And like you said it,
yeah.
You
yeah,
said it don't. Perfectly, Eli, when you said movies were allowed to be for adults. And it is, there's like, especially like the thrillers like this of the time, there's this maturity to them and this feeling of almost like professionalism to it. That like we rarely have in movies now, because there's just this any like major Hollywood movie, even if they try to make sort of a mature grown-up movie like this, there's this sort of studio sheen to it. Like it feels like adulterated, like
right. Because, well, I think part of it is because that like because information is more accessible now, and you can, you know, you can literally, as soon as the credits roll, you can put your feelings on that, whether that's Twitter or Letterboxd, you know, you can literally do it as soon as the credits start rolling. I mean, you can do it before you see the movie. I remember yeah. I've read people do that where they kind of like, before they see the movie, they have like a little dread. But you know, because it's like, how would you can't prepare yourself for what you shouldn't want to, at least.
Yeah.
But then you know, I know that like during that period, that's how conversations happen. You know, the movies really did. That's also why movies would run for like 2-3 months at a time, because, you know, prints used to circulate a little more. They used to have to play them by region and stuff, but it did kind of have a conversation. And so that's why people would keep going to see movies long after they were, mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if they came out in like October, there's entirely a possibility that you could still see it in March the next year. And so I think that's and, you know, and people would talk about it and have like, you know, it'd be like genuine water cooler conversations or party conversations where people would like see this movie and tell other people, oh, yeah, you should really go see this. Or if they both saw it, the way they kind of talked about it, really, it's why like Halloween and The Exorcist horror movies especially benefited from that, just from word of mouth of having to see them. And then when you see like lines for those movies, when you see old pictures, it's like crazy.
Yeah.
This opened at number one, I think, when I was reading up on it. I think it opened, and its number one opening was like $4 million.
Oh my God.
But it finished with like 12 times that.
Wow.
Yeah. Oh, go ahead, Trevor.
Oh, I was just going to say, it was also just like, I mean, obviously it was super relevant at the time because nuclear mm-hmm. power was something mm-hmm. a lot of people were charged up about. But also like right after this movie came out, the Three Mile Island disaster happened, which is like insanely like coincidental that like that must have like this movie must have been like really scary to people. And then to have like actual nuclear meltdown happen like right while the movie was out, like that must have been like this probably really freaked people out.
I remember one of the things I read about that was that Columbia pulled some of the prints because they from specifically mm-hmm. that region, because they didn't want it to look like they were capitalizing on it. So right. Which is funny because now they absolutely would capitalize on it. Yeah. Now it would work that way. And they would even do it where they would be like, oh, if you were involved in or if you or any family members were involved, please
call this hotline.
Right, right. And we'll send you 2 tickets to go see the movie.
Mm-hmm. Like
Yeah, it wouldn't even be like, it would be like, we'll get you that. And then you'll get it's kind of like that Travis Scott thing where he like, was like, oh, you'll also get a 1 month subscription to
better health. Yeah, the Uber.
Right, right. Yeah. And I feel like they would do the same thing. They'd be like, all right, we'll if you were involved and you bought a ticket to the movie, we'll give you a 3 month subscription of Calm or Headspace on us.
Yeah.
I wonder if like even like what if like Clint Eastwood did like his the 15, 17 to Paris thing he did, where he just got like the actual survivors to be in the film.
Yeah, it totally. I mean, it's funny because those kinds of things, it's weird. It's funny how that movie was such a like it was such a blip on the radar, mm-hmm. and that kind of stunt casting used to be like a marquee reason to see the movie. Yeah. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
like if they made the China Syndrome with people involved in one of the nuclear reactors, like in the background. Oh, that would be Michael Mann's The China Syndrome. Would be like the employees were actual nuclear employees, right. And then the three leads spent the year working at the nuclear power plant.
Yeah. Well, you really believe the like Jack Lemmon. I mean, this is a Jack Lemmon podcast, so we got to mm-hmm. talk about how great he is in this mm-hmm. movie.
Absolutely.
Really watching this really reminds me that Jack Lemmon can do it all. You know, because we've watched several Jack Lemmon comedies so far, and he's obviously hilarious. He's great at comedy, but like he gives such a great dramatic performance, and there's like a real authenticity to it. You believe that he's this nuclear engineer and that he's at work and he's a professional. You have Wilford Brimley in what was basically his first movie role, like his first credited role in a movie. Out performance for him, and he mm-hmm. he's a very that he's this guy that he is, and it just feel, you know, it's like if like they made a movie about a nuclear plant now and like Ryan Reynolds, everyone likes to dump on Ryan Reynolds now, but it's just the first name that comes to mind. If Ryan Reynolds was like this nuclear engineer, you know, it'd be like, no, he's not. Come on, you know, like
totally, yeah. I mean, they all play like it's funny. They almost play like proto versions of roles they would take on later. Like when you see Lemon, I actually thought of it. I was like, this is probably what Shelley the Machine Levine was like in his prime when he talked about being like the best salesman. He was probably like the best version of that. And then like Wilford Brimley was almost like the less worn down version of like his character in The Thing. It's just, I don't know. I kept thinking of those things while watching it, but yeah, I couldn't agree more. It's like, it's funny how it's this, it is still a studio movie, a budgeted movie with all people who were names at the time. I mean, Jack Lemmon was a name, the long
name.
Fonda, obviously, that's like post Vietnam mm-hmm. Fonda, so a lot of people knew who she was. And Michael Douglas was on the up.
He was Kirk Douglas's like, son, so mm-hmm. he was already
right, exactly.
Yeah.
And like,
yeah.
And all these people, but in this movie that is very like grounded, even though it's still hitting all the rhythms of like what a movie should have, you are watching a movie that is like it does feel like you're watching it play out in real time, and that you are like a fly on the wall to the situation, especially when it comes to the back half, when it starts to get like really like, oh, what the fuck's gonna happen.
Do
sense like oh, if I was, it does feel like you're there and you're like, this could go so many directions. And it, that's also a testament to how, I think that's probably the director's choice, that he wanted to show, like showing it that way, I think really shows you how casually evil a company will be in the name of PR, you know?
Mm-hmm. It really does give that impression of just how like the system, it really does show like that. I'm trying to think of other examples of this where it's just like the system is broken, like from the ground, from mm-hmm. the top down, and just like the system will just do anything to maintain itself. You even see that how like they force like all of Jack Lemmon's friends against him when he does go like full Joker and takes over the control room. All the people that were like his best friends and coworkers who he drank with and stuff were all like, well, it's a job's a job. We got to do our job. And then like afterwards, when they're still like trying to maintain face and like to get the information out there as they want it, and it's all about like maintaining what they have, and like how like so much of this movie is just like how like they don't care about safety. They just care about the millions that they won't lose.
It didn't occur to me until after the movie, when I was thinking about it before we started recording, that the I think the most powerful, like it's so quietly powerful, is that they could have at any point in that last stretch of the movie where they're being held hostage by one single person who can do anything they want to the room, right? And in theory, he could melt down the entire power plant. All they would have to do is shut down the power plant. They just power it down, and he's rendered useless. But they would literally rather risk leveling a whole city in the name of PR than actually do that, because they wanted that they had the chance to kill, you know, silence him. Mm-hmm. And they would rather do that than kind of just, they could have just shut everything down and arrested him and cart him off to jail.
I don't know about that. I don't think that you actually can just shut down everything without having like some devastating side effect. Like, there are certain systems that they have to keep going at all times to prevent like exposure or something.
Right.
Oh, issue that they're trying to like backdoor it and like shut him down through other means, and then that almost has catastrophic effects.
Mm-hmm. Right, exactly. Mm-hmm. Yeah, because there was a million other ways that could have gone down. No, you're right. I guess what I mean is they couldn't hit an off switch, but they had like a couple other routes they could have taken, but instead they're like, let's get a SWAT team in here and get that as our way to like fix things, because he has literally has a pistol.
Yeah.
Like a that's probably not even completely full.
Yeah.
And yeah, it's funny because even at the end in any other movie, I remember thinking, I'm like, oh, in a lesser movie, I would be like, that whole kind of epilogue would seem, excuse me, more melodramatic. I mean, it kind of is, I guess, even in this movie, but because it's so charged, it feels so much more authentic than it would be like just being like, turning into like a PSA.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, and there's this great offloading of responsibility there, like where they have this institution in place and nobody has to make the deliberate decision to kill Jack Lemmon, you know?
Yeah.
It's like eventually when they break in, the SWAT team guy shoots him because he's a threat. And it's like the fact that they're approaching the situation that way makes it like inevitable that he's going to be taken out. But like the evil guy in charge doesn't have to be like, kill him, you know? It's just kind of like the events are put into motion in a way where he's going to end up dead, which is in their interest. But it's like not, they don't have to like actually like pull the trigger on him.
Yeah, exactly. And
totally.
It's also like, I was thinking of it as well. Just a second ago said like they really could have, when you say like they could have done anything, they literally could have just gone like Wilford Brimley to be like, or anyone to be a mediator. And just be like, okay, Jack, let's do this. I'll take the pistol and we'll go back to work and you can
have
your office again. It's like, they wouldn't even bother with that. They were just like, nope, he's an obstacle on this day. So he must be gone forever.
Just totally. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. That's what I kept thinking. I was just like, wow, the way they could have easily had done this. And then it's funny when they start recording him, he's going on about like all this stuff, and even they're trying to, I think there's, I don't remember if it's Michael Douglas or Jane Fonda, one of them's kind of trying to get him to like talk about the more like the immediate devastating impact this could have, rather than like, you know, because he's going on about, well, this happened last week and my job is that, you know, he's speaking in very technical terms. Mm-hmm. and then they're like, because they you can even sense that they're like, oh no, you're giving this isn't helping at all, you need to kind of like fast. And then when he finally does get to the juicy stuff, they're able to, you know, they activate the thing they're trying to avoid, they activate a version of that to stop him. That's how concerned they are with their PR, that they're like, well, you know what, we'll just do the thing he's trying to avoid and just show that we can fix it, when they actually could, they just got lucky, and that it's probably going to happen again in a few months or something. And it's a great payoff for him when he's laying on the ground and he's like, I can feel the vibration. Like, that's his last dying word. It's like, it's about to happen. The thing that happened to my coffee cup is about to happen to me.
I mean, it's like, it's very, you know, all of the three like main characters are people who are like trying to do their jobs the right way. Mm-hmm. And they all come up against gridlock from the institutions that they're in.
Yeah.
Like Jack Lemmon, you know, they're not like, it's not like a movie about like revolutionaries taking down the system. It's just people who take their job seriously and want to do the right thing, you know?
Absolutely. And you really get to see, one thing I wanted to add about that is that when, like, for example, I think the most telling thing when you're watching the movie in regards to that is, when at the end, when Jane Fonda's trying to get the, trying to interview Wilford Brimley, and it intentionally shows the TV from the monitor from the station, and then you see the adjacent monitor of what's playing live, and it shows like a pinball ad. Like that's what's playing on TV while she's getting ready. I think that's like such a really powerful image, actually, just because it really shows you they're like, well, we got to make sure we get our ad sponsors in, and you're like, there's people all over the city watching a pinball commercial, being like, oh, maybe I should get a pinball machine. And meanwhile, they're like, well, okay, we got to get this on the air about how we just averted a nuclear disaster. Mm-hmm. And they're very, you know, and I, every step of the way, this company paints like everybody is a villain. Immediately, they're just ready. They're like, you know, when you're watching the commission that meeting that they have with where people can come and voice their concerns at the hearings, you know, there's like people who like have their mouths taped shut, and they're like, you know, they can't speak, and our children can't be here because they're dead, and we're gonna name all their names. These people are seen as like, you know, just like, oh, well, what are they doing? Why are they doing this? Just go, you know, they kind of paint them almost as like, as the problem. And then they eventually paint, they look at Michael Douglas as like, oh, he took the film and he took it to the, you know, he took the copies of everything. And then every person's like, you know, they need to do it anonymously or whatever. And then eventually it becomes that their own employee is a villain. Like they'll just, you know, it's like gradually each person, and the corporations come out on that totally clean. They're like, people watching are like, oh yeah, it was a disgruntled employee. Nobody, you know, the implication to me was that like everybody watching it in Los Angeles at the time was just watching a story about a disgruntled worker.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. It's like, just so like, so wild. And then like, when like Wilford Brimley finally like says like, he wasn't a disgruntled worker. He wasn't a drunk. He wasn't crazy. He was the most rational, sane man I've ever known. And then like after he does his whole speech at that point, then like some representative is just like, Wilford Brimley is not the voice of this company. He's an employee and his views do not represent our views as a corporation. And
And I love just that last moment where Jane Fonda gets emotional on camera, like talking about it, because this whole thing, like, and all the energy that led up to this could all just get snuffed out because of the way it kind of went down in the end. But I think like the fact that she has that little moment and gets Wilford Brimley saying that on the record and kind of has that emotional moment is what like shades it with that little like glimmer of like hope at the end, that maybe so that people are going to be like, okay, something wasn't right here, you know? Yeah, but we don't know. We don't know what happens next.
When this screened earlier this month, actually, at the New Beverly, I missed it, and which was kind of one of my other motivations for picking this one. I'm like, oh, you know what? I'll do a Jack Lemmon film I haven't seen yet, and I was like, all right, I missed this at New Bev. When I was watching it, one of the things I was kind of conscious of is I know that like when you watch something at the New Bev, the crowd's like very jazzed up, and I pictured there's a few scenes, one in particular when the head of the the head PR guy from the Ventana, the nuclear company, is talking to the head of the news station. He goes, well, this is very bad journalism at the end. He's like, you guys aren't, you know, this has like no journalistic integrity. And then that guy from the news station goes, I don't hear you right now. I picture that would have sent everybody there. I guarantee you whatever crowd is there would have applauded at that.
Nice. Hell yeah.
Because that is a moment where you're like, oh yeah, okay, good. This is like, anytime anyone gets a chance to be a human being in a setting like that, like an actual empathetic or sympathetic or good person, it, you know, in the face of like a corporate entity, that's like something, that's what people should be applauding at, not at like, you know, Thanos getting erased or whatever.
Yeah, the like just the human component of the story is really touching. Like, even like, you know, because there's this political valence to everything that's happening, but like the characters feel real and they care about something and they get invested in this. And then like, you know, there's that last moment with Jane Fonda on camera, and then Michael Douglas runs up and hugs her at the end, just because like they like shared this thing together, and they have and they've become like closer as friends through this experience. And it's a really it's just a really there's just such real like humanity to it.
And they did my favorite thing, which is they let the credits run completely silent when it cuts to black.
That's
like you really are like, you're like, oh shit, now we gotta sit with this.
it ends so abruptly on the news station monitors, just the same way that it opened on the monitors.
Yeah, and that also was really effective, where it gives you this fluffy opening where they're talking about, you know, singing telegrams and like just how it's a thing where I always kind of, something I always say to myself when I watch a movie from kind of anything from like the 70s to early 80s that kind of feels prescient, that like where you're like, oh, this kind of predicted something. You actually come to realize when you're watching a movie like this that you're like, oh, it's not that it predicted anything. It's just always been this way.
Yeah,
it's
exactly.
It's just now it's like somehow magnified and on fast forward in a way that's like almost overwhelming. But I it's like, oh yeah, I guess in the 70s, back then, journalism already was becoming a joke. Because people will, it is funny that we're talking about how like, oh, movies used to be this way. I mean, I'm sure in the 70s, there were people who felt like, you know, oh no, I miss movies from the, you know, back in the, I'm sure there are people who fucking pined for Hays Code era filmmaking, but like it was a thing where like watching it, you're like, oh, this is why it's New Hollywood, because they kind of really started like deconstructing this shit in a way that I don't think up until the 70s. I mean, if it was happening, it was happening in very, you know, it was like a Douglas Sirk melodrama, or you know, it had to use some kind of very obvious like overlap, and people had to notice that this was a phallic symbol or whatever, you know what I mean? Whereas this is like, oh no, the actual problem is this company, and we're going to make that the problem. And then maybe we'll put a little subplot in there about something else in the meantime, you know?
Oh, for sure. I love when there's like when like bosses have bosses, and like the bosses are annoying, but like the boss of the boss at the news station is just like this, like just this like loud asshole who's just like just very furious and like, get that film, you gotta deal with that girl, you gotta deal with that guy. And it's just so good. It's like he feels like straight out of like a Planet of the Apes movie or something.
100%. Yeah, that's a good point. I didn't think about the bosses having bosses and something like that, because it does just keep going up the line, and you realize you're like, who actually is in charge of all of this, and who actually, like, who did they have to report to that's actually, you know, the CEO, or the, what is it that they actually want out of this whole thing? And then you realize it is like this, just this completely like snake eating its own tail, where everybody's just passing it along. And they just keep passing it along that way until either the nuclear melts down, you know, the plant melts down, or they save the day, one or the other. It's almost like they don't even have a control of how it's going to turn out.
This entrenched like corporate self-interest, you know, and like at that at the boardroom scene where like Michael Douglas gets pissed off and yells at them, they're all like, oh, you know, there's no conspiracy, stop being histrionic, you know, we're just playing by the rules here. And it's like they just have these systems in place so that they can just like make excuses. Like, we can't do that. It's against the rules, you know?
And such a great thing about that, having him be like this freelance guy, is that pays off a little later when they're talking to Jane Fonda, like her boss. And he's like, well, I went to go fire him, but then I saw he didn't work here. And so he couldn't be silenced, and him stealing that footage from the vault. Really? What I'm remembering from the movie, I don't think they ever suggest a criminal charge against him. What they do instead is they just look to Jane Fonda and they're like, well, you're going to get fired if you don't go get this footage back. Because at that point, like once it's out, it's not like they're going to be able to do anything about it. And if they, you know, if they do try to sue, it's going to make them look worse, or, you know, take any kind of legal action. And instead they're like, well, you know, somebody has to pay the price on our end. So if he can't, because he's not a he's not an employee, we'll make you an employee, Jane Fonda, right. Out, you know.
Yeah, it's like, it kind of reminds me of how, like, when you're freelancing, how, like, there really is the worst thing they can do is just be like, well, you can't be paid like $20 here anymore.
Yeah, totally. It is so depressing that it has become like that's kind of now how freelance is affected, because you really now, you'd think that would be more of the more empowering thing to do, but now it leaves you even more beholden, because it, like, to play ball in whatever way you have to, mm-hmm. because otherwise they could just withhold your check and there's really nothing. I mean, I can't tell you how many friends I have that are writers that are waiting on checks for like a full calendar year when they finish the job, and they're just like, oh yeah, I finally got this, but they even said, they're like, but by the time I got it, they're like, it didn't even feel like a sense of relief. It was like, it's that chapter's over. Now I have to go find the next person that's taking too long to pay me.
Yeah. No, yeah, for sure. Oh, also, I always forget to do this off the top of the show. So now it's time for the first question.
Do you have a question for
yes,
Eli?
Yes, I do have a question for Eli. 50 something minutes into the recording, into the episodes. Eli, what is your personal history of Shaq Lemon?
Oh, okay. So great. I'm so glad you caught me off guard with this question, because I didn't want to, I was thinking about that earlier, and it's such a fascinating. So when I was a kid, this isn't the house I grew up in. This is kind of the house I was a teenager in. Mm-hmm. But the first house I lived in, there was a theater about 2 miles away from me that no longer exists, called the AMC Ocean Walk 10. It was a theater on the beach. It was, I think, one of the only movie theaters I could think of that's actually literally on the beach. And my mom let me go see movies at a pretty young age. Like, as long as I was with a friend, I couldn't go by myself. But even at like 10 years old, I was allowed to go with a friend. And sometimes I'd go with my sister, sometimes I'd go with my mother. And that was the period where Walter Matthau and Jack Lemmon had Grumpy Old Men, Grumpier Old Men. That they had that run in the 90s of, mm-hmm. like, senior comedies, mm-hmm. that depending on which one you saw first was kind of a good one. Do you know what I mean? Because none of them are bad movies, but they mm-hmm. all are essentially telling the same joke in just a different setting.
Yeah.
And so if you saw Out to Sea first, it's very possible that you could think that's a great movie and then see Grumpy Old Men and be like, it's an okay movie. So as a kid, I only knew those movies as Jack Lemmon movies. And I liked all of them because I was so young. And then, I mean, the funny thing is I only really can remember Grumpy Old Men and part of Out to Sea. I don't know why I can remember that one specifically, because I saw that way later on, like, pay-per-view, I think. Mm-hmm. But then when I got into like it was about 13, 14 is when you start really like watching stuff. When that's when I kind of started seeing stuff like maybe a little later, actually, like when I was closer to 18, that's when I saw The Apartment, because, you know, it was that's like a screenwriter's reference. And for every like screenwriting book. And then I watched Glengarry Glen Ross, and I flipped my fucking lid. that movie, I must have seen that movie. So the way I saw that movie is, and this is why I was like really excited to tell this story on this podcast. I used to actually have a joke about it. I'm telling you the real version. I'm not doing like a jokey version of it or anything, just to be clear. I'm not doing that hacky bit. But I worked at a Best Buy in Fort Lauderdale, and it was what they were known for at the time when I was in college, is they were not a commission-based company. You actually just got paid hourly, and you had some really good benefits. The employee discount was like incredible there, because you got everything at like cost, and like it was very, saved a lot of money. So I got moved from the DVDs and CDs, which was considered media, to computers, which involved upselling. And the reason they had promoted me, they said, is because this was when Netflix had just become a service strictly for discs. There was no, you know, and it took like a few days to get each one. It wasn't like the overnight service they had in their kind of like heyday of that period. And I apparently had a very good record with signing people up for any kind of movie service. And it's because I liked what I was doing there for a college kid. You know what I mean? So like, well, we're going to promote you to computers. And I was like, okay, I took it just because it was a very substantial raise, but I didn't upsell anything. And they were very upset. So one day my manager brings me into this conference room and he's like, all right, man, look, you are not upselling things here. And you need to really like understand how to, that this is really important. So I'm going to show you a clip of something.
Oh my God.
So you already know where this is going. Yeah. So he fires up the opening scene of Glengarry Glen Ross with Alec Baldwin talking about how it takes brass balls.
That's insane.
Just because I wasn't upselling USB cables and extended warranties. And the only takeaway I remember something else he told me that another employee told me what they used to do before they showed that clip. And he also used to alternate it with clips from Boiler Room, one of like Ben Affleck's monologues. What I heard he did before that is he would apparently say, he would bring him in a room and hand you, we worked across the street from a McDonald's. He would slide over a McDonald's application. He goes, hey, if you don't want to upsell things, you can just always go across the street. For a fucking minimum, I couldn't believe it. I was like, all right, man. I mean, that's a lateral.
That's so insane.
McDonald's. Yeah, it's like the only difference is you just don't smell like food when you're done. But the jobs are the same. He really, you know, but he was so furious when he came back in the room because at first he goes, well, what'd you think? That was kind of intense, right? And I said, I would love to finish this movie. And he was furious. And I literally just went, I went. To the DVD section. I picked up the DVD. I still have it in LA. I kept most of my physical media, and it was an Artisan Release special edition DVD of Glengarry Glen Ross, and that's how you got me to see that movie. And I must have watched that movie like 10 times in a month when it came out. When I bought that DVD, I mean.
It's hilarious to miss the point of Glengarry Glen Ross that hard, like,
yes,
think that scene is gonna like motivate people to sell, like, first of all Alec Baldwin does in that scene is intimidate and threaten and insult them. Like, he doesn't provide like any useful guidance for say, that's not the point of the scene. He's not like telling them how to sell stuff.
So I that night talked, I mean, we me and my friends were at TGI Fridays. I remember this so vividly, and I one of my friends had seen it, and he's like, I think he was trying to get the ABC part across.
Always be closing.
Yeah, always be closing. And I think it's AIDA was the other one, attention, interest, decision, and action. And yeah, right. Well, I can't believe I remember that. So even then we were laughing about it because we were like, even if that's what he wanted to show us, why didn't he just put that on the whiteboard in the office? Why didn't he just write always be closing and tell me to, why didn't he just rip off the monologue himself? and just a fun backstory of that manager. A few months later, he told me one of the worst movies he's ever seen was Punch Drunk Love. So that's what I was dealing with. Just absolutely. He was like, hey, I went to watch an Adam Sandler movie and I got that. And I was just like, yep, you're exactly what that movie is criticizing.
I think, God, like, and the thing that's making me think of is like, there must have been someone like on the Best Buy floor at that time who was dealing with like some customer of coupons. They're like, hey, can let's say his name's John for this.
Sure.
John, could John come to DVDs? I need to deal with this customer who's bitching about coupons. And they're like, sorry, John's showing Eli a clip of a movie.
He's getting him jacked up by showing him Glengarry Glen Ross. And like, it's so funny because what I ultimately learned about that too, about like upselling in that place, is that what's funny about that and what the movie, you know, is that we were at a Best Buy that was in a fairly, like, it wasn't on the affluent side of town. It was down the street from where things started becoming affluent. And that's when those people came in, that's when you sold the things that they were trying to upsell because they were ready to buy them anyways. So it's just a matter of making sure you sussed out the richest person in the room.
Right. Yeah.
And like, that was always funny to me that he like, because I'm wondering at what point did he watch that movie and think to show that to someone and then saw results?
It's so fucking funny to imagine him at a younger, impressionable stage in his life seeing that movie and thinking like, wow, Alec Baldwin, he's the fucking man. He's so cool. I want to be just like that guy. Wow, he has a really expensive watch. holy shit, that guy is awesome.
Right, right. And not being like, oh, Jack Lemmon's character is so past his prime that he had to resort to literal stealing to secure the bag. Mm-hmm. And also, by the way, what's funny, you just kind of made me like realize something about that, which is just that that's a precursor to what is currently happening, where like all these people worship Elon Musk, who's like mm-hmm. genuinely yeah. an objectively awful person, and are like, well, you know what, you gotta, and whenever I hear these people talk, I've looked on Twitter, I've gone so many rabbit holes, especially when all the meme stock stuff really took off. People were like, well, you really got to admit that, like, even though his methods are unorthodox, Elon Musk gets it done. And you're like, what the fuck are you talking about? This guy is literally doesn't want to pay a cent of taxes. And he's literally like, instead of being like this environmentalist who he claims to be in fixing the planet, he's like, well, let's just go to another planet. Mm-hmm. And that for some reason is seen as like, he's like, wow, that guy really knows his stuff. And so it does predate that. You're right. Where it's like, someone watches Glengarry Glen Ross or the Ben Affleck scene in Boiler Room where he's like talking about like vacation time. You want vacation time? Go teach third grade public school or, you know, whatever he, mm-hmm. All that stuff he goes on. I'm just like, how did this guy get seen as like the, every time people watch that movie though, apparently that had the same effect back then, which Boiler Room was kind of like a, that the, not him, but another character in the movie, I think it was Tom Everett Scott's character, was based on Belfort. It was like a pre-Wolf of Wall Street.
Oh, right. Yeah.
It was obviously done with a much lower budget and kind of like a younger filmmaker's kind of take on it. But it's funny because I do feel like a lot of people were watching that and were probably like, oh man, those guys are fucking the adrenaline in that mm-hmm. room. I got to get in on that.
Yeah.
And they are like, it happened now with Wolf of Wall Street. I mean, for the most part, most people get that the movie is a cautionary tale, but there are still, I mean, there are still finance bros who use memes of Leo doing what he's doing in that mm-hmm. movie.
Yeah. Of course, so they all love that movie. And Jordan Belfort probably loves the movie, loves the fact that he's like so much richer now than he would have been if the movie hadn't been made. It was probably a big boost for his public speaking career. And also, frankly, like, I love Wolf of Wall Street. It's one of my favorite Scorsese movies. But you have to admit, he barely gets punished. Like, sure, like, eventually he gets caught for whatever legal thing he's doing. He has to spend a couple years in a white collar prison, but which doesn't really seem that bad. It's like, as prisons go, it's pretty nice. And then he gets mm-hmm. out and he gets to be this public speaker and like keep making a ton of money just by being himself. And then they make a movie about, they sold a book, made a movie about him that he makes even more money off of because it's based on his book. And then all these other guys think he's awesome. Like, his life is great, you know?
Yeah. Which is funny because it serves almost as like a counterpoint to like thinking about like China Syndrome. I didn't see Dark Waters, the movie with Mark Ruffalo that came out a few years ago. I haven't
seen it either.
I've heard it's kind of similar to this, where it's about like a, I forget if it was like not Procter & Gamble, but some company that was
Dow Chemical.
Yeah, Dow Chemicals. Or... Yeah, and how they poisoned literally an entire community.
Yeah,
and it's apparently very similar to this, where it's like very sturdy, really gets its point across, but it obviously is like a complete downer. And it's really funny when you do make these stories that are supposed to be warnings of like The Wolf of Wall Street is like a movie that's like, this is why capitalism sucks mm-hmm. and how many problems there are, and then like China Syndrome. You know, if someone sat down to watch that, they would be like, well, that was good, but now I'm depressed. You know what I mean? Like, that's mm-hmm. almost the flip side to when you make a movie that's like, well, this is an important movie because it's about something, you know, at the time. And now people would be like, oh, it's so depressing. I mean, but to be fair, China Syndrome did well. Like, it mm-hmm. made, not only did it make money, but I think it got like Oscar nominations too at the time.
Yeah. It's DuPont, by the way, not Dow.
Oh, that's DuPont. Yeah, you're right. Yeah, DuPont. Because mm-hmm. I remember, I knew it was about a blue blood family, which is funny. Even the DuPont family, like, you know, what's his name? That one DuPont killed somebody, and his prison is literally on his property.
Oh my God.
Literally, they paid to build a prison, which he lives, which is like an estate. It's like insane.
I wanted to say, in like terms of people showing clips from things, this was in high school. I had this like super into Reagan history teacher who was just such a dipshit, and like literally he would like you could read Bill O'Reilly books for extra credits.
Whoa.
Yeah.
Wow.
Mm-hmm. And I don't even remember the context, but he played the theme song to All in the Family, and I was like, this is very thoughtful.
Oh my god.
That is very, oh my god, that's insane. That's, oh my god. Yeah, it is weird.
Those really were the days.
Yeah, I know. Yeah, I think about that too when I watched like stuff, like the stuff we got to watch in who we had in high school. It is really funny that your teachers were either there were the three types of teachers. There was that, like a raging conservative teacher, and you really, you know, like if you didn't stand up for the pledge, that was you got a referral. Mm-hmm. There's the opposite, a very a progressive teacher, or you just had the person that just wanted to do their job and go home.
Yeah,
like those are the three.
In high school I took this philosophy class, and it was taught by this he was history or English teacher or something. But he was this very well-liked teacher who was kind of almost retired. Like he was kind of on his way out, and he was teaching this like extracurricular philosophy class. And he would basically just show us movies that he liked and like make an excuse for why it's, and like, we watched good movies. We watched like Cool Hand Luke and On the Waterfront.
Oh, hell yeah.
You know, and he would be like, this is On the Waterfront. This is basic. This movie is like about existentialism.
Yeah, go ahead.
No, that's pretty much the story. It was supposed to be a philosophy class. You'd be like, yeah, Cool Hand Luke is it's kind of like about Kant or whatever. Yeah.
Yeah, I'm trying to pull up, and there's something that Jack Lemmon did. Well, the other movie I was going to pick, by the way, that no one had picked at the time was JFK.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Which I don't know if someone's gotten to it yet, but it's funny because in the 90s, when I was most like that, that's when I became most like familiar with him. And then before I started like going back and seeing stuff, he really had when I discovered his comedies, I guess, you know, like Out of Towners and stuff, mm-hmm. It is a thing where you're like, oh, this is, so, it's almost like he took, like, it's what you see De Niro doing now, where he's doing these comedies. But the difference in the two of like what kind of comedies they chose to do at the end of their career, you know what I mean? You could tell Jack Lemmon was still like, because the last decade of his film career, I think his last thing was Legend of Bagger Vance, or The Odd Couple too.
I think Bagger Vance was right after that.
Yeah, yeah, after that was 2000. Yeah, that's right. So. When you watch that and you're like, oh, in his last 10 years, he only really did like JFK. He loved just doing stuff with Walter Matthau. Clearly they just had a ball. Mm-hmm. Whereas like Robert De Niro was like, okay, I'll do this kids movie where hijinks ensue. And I never even saw it. Like, I don't know mm-hmm. anything, you know what I mean? I still to this date haven't seen Little Fockers. It looks embarrassing.
Yeah. Lemmon also did a lot of, TV movies towards the end. He was in like Tuesdays with Maury. Remake of 12 Angry Men, which I want to see. It's got an interesting cast.
The first time I saw 12 Angry Men was that version.
Nice. Yeah, I mean, it's cool. It has James Gandolfini and like an interesting cast. I'd like to see it. Was it good?
I remember liking it. Well, here's how he saw it. I saw it in 10th grade. A teacher showed us. So what he did was he showed us the original version, the black and white version. Uh-huh. And when he showed us that version, he showed us on purpose because he goes, he's like, I want you guys to have a good laugh at the kid that they show as like who supposedly did the stabbing, because he literally looks like all that's missing is a halo. Like he's such a sweet looking boy. Uh-huh. He looks so boyish that there's no way in any way, shape or form, which is kind of fucked up. I'm like, why are we all pointing and laughing at this in retrospect? But then he showed us that version because I think he thought that, we would more likely pay attention to it. So, mm-hmm. I mean, as far as 15-year-old Eli goes, it was a 2 thumbs up movie. What I would think about it now, great question. That was an HBO movie, right?
Maybe. I'm not. I just Not sure.
Also, I did want to say, we, if you'd like, you could reserve the JFK episode for when we go to Mathel May around May.
Well, we're getting into off mic talk here.
Yeah.
Talk about that after.
Okay.
I got so excited, but yes, already. I want that on record. Yes.
Okay. We're definitely going to do JFK and we can do that for sure. Oh, go ahead, Valerie.
So I wanted to talk about another, because I've only seen, I think this is the second James Bridges movie I've seen. I've seen this, and I've also seen Bright Lights, Big City, starring Michael J. Fox. I
saw that. Did Paul Schrader write that, by the way? Am I thinking the right?
No, that was Light of Day that Paul Schrader wrote.
That's right.
Does feel very Schrader-y.
Oh, no, Bright Lights, Big City, that's the one based on the book, right?
The book, yeah.
So let me pull up James Bridges' filmography, because to answer your question, I have seen that. I haven't seen much of his stuff either. And it's a shame that Nubev is, the reason they showed the China Syndrome, it was a James Bridges tribute. So what I have seen of his, I know that I've seen Urban Cowboy. I haven't seen Perfect in its entirety, but I know there's a scene with John Travolta and Jamie Lee Curtis that I've used the video clip on Twitter 1,000 times of them dancing. She teaches like some kind of aerobics class, and she's like thrusting her hips and he's matching it. And that's supposed to be like the sexual tension between, like supposed to sync up the sexual tension. But all you're really watching is just incredible. Like, oh, it's almost like proto twerking. It looked like with both of them just like literally shoving their crotches towards each other's direction.
I've seen none of these movies. I just checked. I've seen nothing by him.
Yeah, I mean, I remember liking Bright Lights, Big City. I haven't seen it since I was like at like 22 maybe. But I remember when I saw it, I did like it.
Yeah, I really enjoyed that one. I think it's like, it's such a good Michael J. Fox performance, like, and it like is, a yeah. rare like dramatic performance. Like I still need to see like Casualties of War and like a couple of and the Schrader movie he did and a couple others, but yeah, he was a great dramatic actor when he did use that like skill. What's your take on Urban Cowboy and the other Bridges, the other James?
So that's the only other one I've seen, and I saw it. I remember I saw that in high school. So mm-hmm. I remember I saw it at a friend's house because it was just the only thing on TV, and he didn't mm-hmm. have cable, so we just had to watch what we had. And I remember being bored by it, but I think not because it was a boring movie, but because I was too young to appreciate it. You know what mm-hmm. I mean? I would like to revisit it now. The amount of James Bridges movies they're showing is like, it's like the bulk of his filmography. So I was a little bummed that I couldn't make it. One of my friends went to one of his movies. I think it was Paper Chase or the September 30th, 55. He went to one of them and said it was very good.
Oh, nice.
He seems like a very, like a real craftsman, you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. Like he's just you give him the assignment and he's gonna direct the hell out of that assignment. That's what this felt like with this movie, you know what I mean? He's like, all right, this is what it's about. We're gonna do the best possible version of that.
Mm-hmm, for sure. And I didn't notice until looking at his Wikipedia before that he's a gay filmmaker, and it seems like he was out because his like his companion was like listening to Wikipedia, and they never like said like he came out or whatever, and his boyfriend was also like an ex-boyfriend of Montgomery Clift's.
Whoa, really?
Yeah,
wow. Mm-hmm. The thing that also, by the way, I'm convinced that whenever whether they're out or not, if it's not a straight director directing the movie, you're always going to get a scene like where Jane Fonda is being told, hey, you can't we didn't just hire you for your journalistic integrity. Like it always is a thing where whatever version that someone who's not like a guy at the top is struggling with, that will always, they'll always find a way to put that in a, you know what I mean? Someone who has ever been marginalized or have any kind of issue, that will always be, I think they'll, that'll find a way in, you know what I mean?
For sure. Yeah.
I don't know why
his partner, not important. Go ahead.
Oh, I was just going to say that he, yeah. I mean, I think that like, anytime, that's also probably why the movie didn't play with any kind of like, well, I guess that's why it puts, how do I articulate this? I guess what I was getting at is that, like, I feel like in a more rigid director, or like, it would be something more, it would be more so focused on its masculinity about saving the day, or, you know what I mean? Like, I don't think it would be Jack Lemmon. Do you get what I'm saying? Like,
yeah, no, I get it. Yeah.
Maybe that's why Michael Douglas looked so hot in the movie.
Yeah,
but you know what I mean. Maybe that's why he was made to look just so damn hot. And and Jane Fonda was given like the more traditional, like workmanlike approach to the job, and being very, you know, because also the character wants to be taken seriously as a woman.
For sure. Trevor, what were you going to say about his boyfriend?
Yeah, yeah.
Oh, he played Jimmy Olsen on the old Superman show from the 50s.
The black and white one? The George
Reed
one?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Oh, my God. Oh, that's funny.
That rocks.
Do we have any other thoughts about... what was the movie called? The China Syndrome? before we wrap up.
This was a 4-star Ebert review.
Oh, wow. Nice.
Roger Ebert gave it 4 stars. I didn't check to see if it made his top 10 that year. But yeah, he thought it was a very compelling movie because it was a very human story, is what he said, you know, at the center of all its tropes and like, you know, its genre elements.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. I agree.
Yeah.
I love Jack Lemmon in this movie. Great performance.
So good. So good.
Yeah.
Really a very human performance.
I also, that's Roger what I was going to say. I also like that Lemmon is like, I like that the movie doesn't start with him, but it does become his, you know, he is the guy that really the movie, that to me is like a very tricky character. That, I guess what I'm getting at is that to me says he, he just wanted to do the best job possible with that, because I know the thing of actors, obviously vanity is a thing. He would try to make that more his movie in a way that, you know, cause he is also, I think, first billed in the movie, but I think he still doesn't act like he's first billed. He acts like whatever he needs to act like, you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. Because you're never really following his point of view aside from that first, that stretch where he goes to see the nuclear waste and do the radiation readings. There's all, you know, Bridges is very confident in waiting until Lemmon needs to be Lemmon. You know what I mean?
Right, because he's at the center of the story. He's sort of the subject, and then Jane Fonda is like the protagonist because we're following the investigation. But
totally.
But he starts off as like the company man. And when Jane Fonda first talks to him, he's like, you know, kind of defending, being like, oh no, it wasn't really a big deal. It was a small thing, you know, and like obviously he probably already has like the seed of doubt in his mind, but it hasn't started to metastasize into this moral conflict yet. But then, and then like, there's this sort of little spark between him. I love that bar scene in the middle with him and
Joe. So
yes.
Like,
yeah. It's like he's kind of trying to like have sex with her a little bit. Like it doesn't, I feel like there's like just a slight undercurrent of him being like, well, hey, why don't you just stay around here tonight?
Totally.
You know, you can stay somewhere nearby. Yeah.
mm-hmm. Well, that again goes back to like the way everyone treats Jane Fonda, that pays that off, where at first he's like, oh, you're just a fluff reporter doing fluff stuff. You know, well, yeah, why don't you come here? Let's see what we can make happen. And then literally at the snap of a finger, he suddenly like, no, look, this actually was one of the worst things that could have possibly happened. You guys could have been killed today. He like really out of nowhere is like, all right, she's obviously taking this very seriously, so I'm going to take it seriously too now. And and you could see how everyone at the bar is like, let me buy you a drink, let me get an autograph.
Yeah,
you.
Yeah.
Everybody's looking at her like they're like puppies.
Yeah, I had three final things I wanted to say. First, I love the car scenes. The car scenes were so good in this. Mm-hmm. I didn't expect them to be as good as they were, like the like just a couple chases there were. And like I particularly liked the scene where they were chasing Jack Lemmon, and the one car that was able to like the other cars crashed, but the one car was able to like go down the grass and like follow. And it's like, God, that's like something right out of Smoking the Bandit or something. That was so good.
Yeah, absolutely. Especially when they, and even when you see the other, when the sound guy gets run off the road, like the way that's treated, it's so like, it really, again, is like a grounded thing where you see him just hit the brakes. He's just hitting his brakes and the car is, he's no longer has any say with what's going to happen. Because they're put, you know, this big truck is, and it's, yeah, it's done so casually. You just see it approaching. There's no dramatic music at mm-hmm. any point. It just completely, just every, like it's, and I think most of the movie doesn't, I think at the end, when you look at the song credits, there's literally like one song that's credited. It like, it's such a, it, oh, it just lets
the song, the out. Song that plays at the beginning is a banger, honestly. Yeah. Like when that,
yeah,
that,
yeah.
It, that kind of really like, got, that got me like kind of excited. I was like, yeah, all right. This is a. groovy movie.
And
that's why like I was saying up top where I was like, well, I thought this was just going to be like a typical, like, you know, it was going to have a very specific kind of like that 70s, not glacial rhythm, but it was really going to take its time. And then it doesn't, because then you don't hear a song again, but it moves with the tension that like mm-hmm. just most movies can't ever get there.
Yeah. And the song was actually the second thing I was going to bring up. But we brought it up. But yeah, it is so good. And it's just like, I love how like that and like the little bit of synth that plays like at the party and stuff, like how it's just like,
yeah,
it's so 70s in like the best way possible. And it's like, it's just so good. And like, I think we said this at the beginning of the call, me and Eli, like, it was just like, I said to him, like this movie does have like a very like Uncut Gemsy type pace to it. But like you, Eli, said earlier, it's instead of just Howie, it's the entire like LA.
Yeah, it's like the city of Los Angeles is actually at stake. It's like the tension's entirely built on like not just one person's life, like 6 million lives or however many people live in LA at that time. Mm-hmm. And are just like ready to, and that even back then, it's also depressing that like there were people who had to go to these hearings because their kids died of some kind of nuclear, you know, them building it there caused like a, some kind of long-term effect.
Mm-hmm. And last thing I want to say is just like, I just always love seeing like 70s interiors in movies. That's always like a thing I love, just because like I love the Bob Newhart Show for the same reason the first one, because it's also like just a bunch of 70s interiors. And like, I don't know, I think it's just because like my grandma's house, she hasn't updated at all since like 1972, so it's just like I'm just so used to that sort of house. So
it's just so like that aesthetic has a certain type, it's a certain type of look, but it's also a certain type of color and a certain type of, you know, now like everything, because everything has to be done by computer, so many things are grayed out. You mm-hmm. know what I mean? Like, like movies are just a literal grayscale with how gray or not gray they are. And instead you get this movie that just looks like real life. You know what I mean? Like colors mm-hmm. don't even have to pop. You just, it's like you almost now notice it more because of that. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. For sure. And yeah, that's basically all I had to say. Trevor, got anything to say? Eli, got anything to say?
We already said our things.
Okay. So, from there, Eli, thank you so much for coming on. It's great.
Oh, thank you for having me. Yeah, it's great talking to both of you. This is such a fun thing. When Mathau May comes around, I am so in. I just want it on the record.
I don't think that the thing is, Lemmon and Mathau both have very small parts in JFK, but I think Lemmon has the larger part than Mathau.
He does.
By far.
Yeah, he does.
I don't think we need to wait till Mathau May to do JFK. So But yeah, we'll figure that out. We'll definitely have you back for JFK, because that's a movie I've been wanting to talk about.
Hell yeah.
Same. Yeah, yeah. That's another one that I could talk a lot. Yeah, yeah. I mean, that's a movie that I think is designed for, like, you can't not discuss it. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah. Do you have anything you want to plug or shout out before we go?
I will be bringing back, I think, in the beginning of the year of next year, 2022, Closure, the podcast that never ends, should be coming back. And I will be, I haven't gone back to stand up yet. It wasn't stable enough for me to want to try and book stuff. And so I'll be on the road and stuff more next year. But you can find all that on any of my socials. I'm at Eli Olsberg, just across the board.
Nice.
Great.
And would you like to say anything about, like, what Closure, the podcast that never ends, is? Like, what's
Oh, sure. Yeah, yeah. I mean, the title's, like, my favorite part of it, to be honest, mm-hmm. because it gives such an open. But I think that it's a podcast. Basically, I interview people about whatever it is they want to talk about, whether it's a relationship and a specific problem, an event. It could be anything. And we just try to figure out, based on that event, if closure does or does not exist for them, and how that whole event and everything, how defining it can be. And so I kind of try to keep it as loose as possible for that, because I find that whatever version of, because I want it to be their version of whatever closure means, and whether they think it's real or not, and that kind of stuff. It's funny, the word closure itself, I used to kind of try to make it a point to bring it up. It never even comes up anymore, but it doesn't even have to, because it, like, permeates the whole show.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I want to just it's a very good show. I've listened to multiple episodes of it.
Thank you.
I told you a couple before, but I've listened to more than I said. Like, I listened to the Julie McCullough, the Deborah DiGiovanni, the Dave Ross, Jake Wiseman episodes. So good.
Those are again all. I was happy with all of them, because they all touch on. Even if, like, some of them are the same, because, like, I know Julian and Deborah both are about sobriety, but different forms of sobriety. And, like, you know, there's, like, so many variables to each person with how they approach that kind of stuff. Because there are, you know, some people, it's a very meetings-based thing. I mean, like I said, with Deborah's episode, I didn't even know you could be addicted to weed in that way, the way she talks about how much money she was dropping. I was just, like, blown away. And so to hear, like, what that means and the ongoing things about that. And, like, you know, it also gets to answer a lot of questions that, like I did an episode where I talked to just a friend about having his first child, and, like, what that actually means for someone my age that I've known a long time, where we used to just fucking run around and do open mics all night, like, what that actually means now. And, like, how, obviously you don't have closure from having a kid, but how it kind of, like, changes your life permanently. It was just as fascinating to me as talking about, like, you know, I remember Jake's back surgery, Jake Weissman, his whole episode was about that. And I mean, I remember in real time, and talking about it in retrospect was, like, mind blowing.
So check it out, and be ready for when Closure, the podcast never ends, returns. And it seems that our episode has come to its own closure.
Boom! Got it. That was a good tie-up. Yeah, thanks again for having it. It was so much fun. It was really nice meeting both of you. Finally getting to meet Valerie. We've been mutuals for a while.
Yeah.
Well, it was good to meet you. Talking to you for the first time. Also. There's a harbor around the corner. Yeah. Thanks for listening, everybody.
Bye.
Stay there long.